This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jimmy hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest. Here's a song about drinking beer and studying for final exams. Bartender, bartender, give me a drink. I got a final tomorrow. I need the power to think. It's 2 a.m. and everybody's gone to bed.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's Phil Pritchett with the weekly podcast from Trinidad World Recording Studios in Fort Worth, Texas. I, of course, am Phil Pritchett, your host here at the P2 Podcast. We have a very fun show here lined up for you because we do have a special guest here in studio. We're going to be talking here with one Blake Walker, a longtime fan, sometime road manager for the full band.
Oh, yeah.
A man who has been there through thick and thin for Phil Pritchett and the full band, really over about the last 10 years in varying degrees. He is here. How you doing, Blake?
I'm wonderful. I'm just skated out of work and am so excited to be a part of the great podcast.
Hey, man. Well, we're going to get into kind of how Blake came to be, why he's here in our first segment. And then in our second segment, it's great that you're here to help me through this, Walker. It's going to be a therapeutic thing for me because we're going to look at a dark day in full band history.
So dark.
The day the Pritchett van was stolen. Oh. Was it a Motel 6 in Houston?
It was.
A Motel 6 in Houston, Texas. East Houston. They told me to stay away from there. I didn't listen.
Ouch.
Oh, man. So we're going to painfully recount and, remember and recall and try to bring people up to speed on kind of how that all went down. Because it was a confusing time. Boy. You saw me playing different guitars, amps, driving around in little rental cars, the band taking different cars.
Phil wearing the same shirt at every show.
Same shirt
good
at every
times.
Show.
It's good times.
There was stuff was never recovered. Police reports were filed. So that's going to be in our middle section. What happened there, the day the van was stolen, and then I've gotten some emails on this, some preliminary emails. There's a lot of confusion, perhaps, in some fan areas out there. We're going to take an in-depth look in the P2 Vault, our third and final section today, at Phil Comes Alive, the making of that landmark 1997 album. Landmark in my world, for sure.
Landmark.
Where I went from, a guy starting out and just banging around to a dude that was, starting to think, hey, maybe I can, keep this thing going for the rest of my life. So we'll take a good look at that. Phil Comes Alive, Austin, Texas, recorded back in 1997. Is that right? Let me take a look here. 97. I think it was actually recorded, though, in... No, that's right. It was recorded in 97, released in 97. Phil Comes Alive. So that's come up here a little bit later. But back to our man Blake here. Blake is a proud graduate of Texas A&M University.
Whoop.
And he came to at least my attention, some of the Fitzwillie shows. Now, what year would that have been?
Man, gosh.
Late, like, when were you in school down there?
99 was the first time we ever met. There was no way you had any clue who I was. But in 98, all the older guys in my high school were passing around Phil Comes Alive. And one of my buddies, Brian Verhalen and Cullen Kiefer, they had an older brother who was in a frat at Arkansas State. And the great Phil had played a just a frat party up there at Arkansas State, and they had come.
Back. Where was that?
Gosh, this must have been in sometime '98. Because
okay, that's probably right. That's probably right.
Brian's older brother, who kind of would buy us beer, and you know, we'd learn the ropes through him. He kind of handed down the Phil Comes Alive to a bunch of us in high school, and so we got a hold of it and started passing it around. And that was the first time I'd ever heard Phil. And so I was way into depressing before there was emo. There was just there's Weezer, and there was just, you know, back then it was, you know.
You were a brooding guy, a serious college student, you know, a deep thinker.
Oh, yeah. And in high school, I was just trying to figure out, you know, I was first listening to all kinds of stuff. And so got handed Phil Comes Alive. We enjoyed it. We started getting into the whole Texas music scene at that point, which was just blowing up with.
Yeah, that's right.
Pat Green and Dance Hall Dreamer and all these things were coming out, and so everyone in high school wanted to be cool and listen to what the college.
Well, we kind of covered that on a previous episode. Someone, our man Kurt South, who joins me for a lot of these, made the point that you know, yeah, in the late '90s, it's kind of hard to remember some of us who've been around here the last 15 years or so that there just weren't any Texas bands. I mean, of course, you had Keen, you had Joe Ely, Jerry Jeff Walker, but those are kind of major label acts. I mean, we all knew who those guys were. But you had Jack Ingram, Jacko Pierce, maybe.
The old 97s were getting real popular.
Yeah, they started kind of coming out, but even they were on Bloodshot out of Chicago. I mean, they're more of like a signed band. But as far as, you know, guys driving around, you know, selling CDs out of the back of their car, it was still a big deal to have a CD, like in 1995 or 6, you know, when I started making them. So you stumbled across the Phil Comes Alive, of course, chock full with all sorts of beer drinking college revelry songs.
It was really popular at my high school. Everybody was listening to that. So and all those albums were coming out, and you wanted to buy something local. Everyone wanted someone from Dallas. That was cool to have a local band CD.
Right.
So your stuff was really heavy rotation through us in high school.
And, oh, that's good to hear. That's so good to hear.
We really got into that, and then of course Suburban Legends came out, and we were really heavy into that. And then in '99, I was a freshman at the great Texas A&M University, and I was strolling across campus, and I'd only heard the albums. I'd never seen or met or been to a show. The only show I'd ever been to was like a Weezer show at Deep Ellum Live. That was like my first concert ever. So I had
a life-changing experience.
Absolutely,
I'm sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, I'm walking across campus, and I see this poster of like this young, Highland Parked out Phil Pritchett, short hair, holding a bag of dried fruit. And it just says, you know, Suburban Legends.
I don't think I've ever lived that down, you know, the dry fruit thing.
And so I'm walking across campus, and I stop, and I kind of look, and I'm like, I know of this guy. And I look at the poster, and it's like live at Fitzwillie's Wednesday night, Phil Pritchett. And so I call my buddies back home, and some of my buddies from TCU drove down, and we got some fake IDs, and we went in there into Fitzwillie's. We showed up about 4 hours too early, and my cousin was fresh out of rehab, and he had just moved to College Station, and I'd put him right.
I hope you didn't give him the record then, because that would have done him a whole lot of good. I don't think.
He took us to Fitzwillie's. Of course, we got there about 4 hours too early, and Phil just got out and played a great live show, and about halfway through.
If you are there 4 hours early, you probably got to see me set up my own PA and eat a hamburger. I was out there kind of messing with my pedals and trying to look like I knew what I was doing.
And this was the old band. You had the guitarist who played the guitar, I think, upside down, left-handed.
Yeah, Andrew Knafziger. Yeah, so this would have been like,
It's 99.
99, yeah.
And Doug, the bass player.
Doug Holm on bass, who we talked about in previous episodes. Yes.
The guy who kind of looked like Murray, who was always smoking a cigarette playing the drums.
Andrew Gerfers.
Murray from Old 97.
Also a left-handed player. Okay. We had two left-handed Andrews in the band, Andrew Knafziger and Andrew Gerfers.
Okay, and then the great Troy Johnson was road managing.
Yes, Troy, yeah.
So we kind of saw all this. We went to a bunch of shows.
We must have looked pretty big time to a couple of guys out there.
It was life-changing. It was very big time. It set the tone for all live shows from that point forward, but I kind of just made it a point to, I think pretty much from that show until about a 4 or 5 year stretch, I didn't miss a show in Nacogdoches, Dallas, or College Station.
Yeah, and that's how we...
I was always there.
We came to know you then, and it sadly happens in this business, in my experience. You know, how did you... You had gotten out of college, and then we were in need of a road manager, someone to come along and help with the gear, you know. Get those hotel rooms and all that kind of stuff. And Blake was a top candidate. Now, what point were I'm confused on when that happened.
Okay.
And how did that come about? Because Blake, really, the reason he's here today, and thank him for his enthusiasm about the band. Yeah, he did. He was here as a road manager for the band shortly after Jordan Powell, had left. Is that correct?
That's correct.
We had Jordan Powell for a while. He was really our first. We had Troy Johnson, of course, and then Jordan.
You had gone to Nashville, broken everyone's heart. All the freshmen at A&M, like me, we were stuck wondering. But you went off to Nashville, and then that's when I guess Troy left. And then when you came back from Nashville,
correct,
Stolle and Lynch joined the band, and you got JP. I guess Jordan was with Roger Krieger before that?
He was, he did some stuff with Krieger and some stuff with the great Chris Wall.
Uh-huh. Wow, and there's a whole other story there, too.
That's a whole
other
episode there. But so Jordan, he had left me. He had gotten hired by Jack Ingram and would later go on to be Miranda Lambert's tour manager, which he currently now, the post he currently now holds. But Walker, he is a part of the machine now.
He's a part of the machine now. We still love
Walker came on board, just to let the fans in here, the road manager is very, in a very interesting, we kind of play it on the fly now. We take whoever wants to come along.
Let's not say that. There's still a screening process, and you must
There's
be cool enough to make it.
A small screening process, I'd say.
I had a roommate that had a class with Jordan Powell, and so we would always be at these shows, and we'd see Jordan back there hauling in t-shirts and CDs and mic check and all this. And so we kind of recognized him on campus. And so my buddy Nate, who I lived with, had an English class with JP, and he had let Jordan borrow a book. And so Jordan he kind of knew us. We always said hello and, hey, you guys go to A&M, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes we'd help him sell t-shirts and hats and CDs. And so Jordan had brought this book back. And he hung out in the house for a little bit, and we were, we dipped some Barry Snuff and played college football on PlayStation 2. And
I think my van still smells like Barry Snuff from all that.
And Jordan. So our friendship just kind of blossomed from there. So Jordan and I would always hang out. He was only in College Station, 2-3 days a week. Then he was on the road with you guys. So when he was there, he'd come hang out, and so we would just spend a lot of time together. And so eventually, when he got the nod and was like, "Hey, I'm gonna go work for Jack," and he's like, "I really think you should think about coming to work for Phil." And he's like, "Phil said he really wants you to come, and he'd be happy to have you come road manage for a while." And so Jordan kind of prepped me on everything. He kind of schooled me. I was very green. I still can't play the
schooled
guitar.
Schooled you on how to get beer for the band. And how to bring warm towels in and or whatever. We were pretty, we're only a three-piece band, so it was pretty, a lot of it was just sort of running around, having someone run around the club. Sell the merch, of course, was big.
Oh, yeah.
And so you came on board. What were some of your first shows there? I'm trying to remember couple of the first times you went with us too.
I was off and on there. My last couple years in Aggieland, I would meet up with you guys on the road and help out. And we were doing the first big road shows that I rode in the van and went on. The first one ever was Chili Fest. You guys had a bus, came
okay,
through.
Okay, yeah, right.
Picked me up, did Chili Fest. Stayed on the bus. I guess we went through Houston, did a couple shows. We might have ended up that stretch in Corpus or somewhere.
But that was with Stolle and Lynch in the new band.
Yes.
Okay, so that era starting there.
So Jordan kind of phased out, and then when I graduated, I basically begged my fiance at the time, was like, give me a year on the road with Phil.
Yeah.
Most kids graduate.
Go to Europe or have one wild fling. I'm going to travel the world. You just said, man, I'm going to go on the road with the full band.
Yeah. And, that was my dream.
Make it happen.
So I worked during the week for contracting company, Monday through Thursday, and then I'd hit the road. And so we basically did the Houston, Corpus, Galveston, and then we did Amarillo and Lubbock, and
just all over Texas, all the usual haunts, man.
Oh,
Blake
yeah.
was there. You sell that merch, man. You sold that merch pretty well for a guy. Doug Holmes' old girlfriend, who became his lovely wife now, Jenny, used to sell the merch. You probably remember.
Yes, I do.
Willis.
I do.
Sweet Jenny, great girl, man. You get a pretty girl back there selling the merch, man. You'll sell some merch.
She
man.
Could kill
sell
it.
Those t-shirts. But Walker was—you were quite adept, quite a good salesman.
I am
moved
pleased.
A lot of those P2 camouflage hats.
Oh man, that was
trucker
hot
hats,
item.
Hot item.
Hot
back there
item
at the tap. around the live record, man. We used to sell it. Had a couple big nights over there.
Oh yeah, we killed it. The camo hat in Aggieland is always a major staple attire. Everybody's rocking the camo hat and the big redneck wallet. So we had
the bullseye there on the hats for the while. It appears in recent years that the hat craze has sort of died off in the colleges a bit.
Yeah,
dudes are just letting the hair go. Kind of, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah,
you know,
it's the
you're kind of an old
look.
School guy. It's kind of the 70s thing, man. Yeah. The ball caps are a little not as common because we do not sell as many, I feel like, hats.
The khaki.
We'd have to get some merch talk maybe with some future episode.
Because
I tell you what, everybody knows I'm very strongly opinionated about merch.
Yeah.
Basically, that I think is ridiculously overrated as far as a moneymaker. Important for fans, yes. An ego for the group, no question about it.
Yeah.
But a lot of bands will tell you how much money they make on their merch, and if you put pen to paper, it's a difficult thing to prove.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Blake Walker is here. He became known as Walker, Texas Road Manager.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
That's
what
he was. And, man, he was there on perhaps, really, no doubt, right? The darkest day of Phil Pritchett and the Full Band history.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely.
And, of course, I'm talking about we were going down to play Gator Fest. We'd played Fitzgerald's in Houston, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
We were playing Gator Fest in Anahuac
the next day
with our friends, you know, Corey Morrow and
Honey Brown.
I think Aaron Watson was there.
There was a bunch of guys on that list.
But the Fitzgerald's show went fine. We had our friend Jack Ingram came over. Remember, Ingram got up and played some. He came out for the encore. Ingram and Chris Masterson, who's now with Sunvolt.
Yes.
Came out. We did Biloxi. We did maybe a Barbie doll or something. I don't know. We had a good crowd that night. Great show.
That place is, I don't know if anyone's ever been there, but it's not in the best part of town.
Yeah.
It's an old, it used to be a stagecoach and a
Did it really? I didn't know that. Fitzgerald's?
Because they're always talking about backstage, when you get way back in there, the people who worked there were always saying, oh, it's haunted and there's this and that. And so I would always ask the lady that was there about the whole, you know, how it became about. It looked like a huge plantation home in the middle of a neighborhood.
That's right, yeah. And it was right just, on the corner of Post Oak and a White Oak and, what's that cross street there? Anyway, yeah, it's right in the hood.
Right
there,
And it was like all painted just pitch black.
Yeah,
and you go inside, the lighting's terrible. It's like 5,000 years old. The ceiling's real low when you're upstairs next to the bar. And then the stage is huge. And we always had a good crowd there, really rowdy, hardcore drinking
crowd. It's a
great
upstairs room.
The
high ceiling and the big stage. And man, some of our real great early Houston shows were indeed at Fitzgerald's. So that night we played with Ingram. He was there. We stayed up late. We closed down the bar. Oh, man, it was 2 or 3 in the morning. We were up there talking business and sharing stories. And it all fell apart after that. We're going to get into that the day the van was stolen. When we come right back, stick around. Welcome back, everybody. Phil Pritchett here, the P2 Podcast you're listening to. You can subscribe to the podcast, www.philpritchett.com. So email us. Email us your questions, other things you'd like to see addressed here on the podcast, on the show, to phil@philpritchett.com. All the albums can be had for $4 a piece at p2tunes.com. And subscribe to the podcast. Tell your friends about it. We come to you weekly here from Trinidad World Recording, my recording studio here in Fort Worth, Texas. Blake Walker, our old road manager and longtime friend, is here with us today.
Hello.
We're revisiting, you know, it's kind of hindsight. Everything's kind of funny when you look back on it a little bit. Because we've had some good laughs about the incident, but it was painful. We, that of course, the day the van, the Pritchett van that we had for a while, was stolen. I bought that van in 1998. Whew. Suburban's era, started taking it to shows. And man, I remember Roger Kreger and, Corey Marr on, people saying, man, that's a nice van. I had like the nicest ride of any Texas. It was, a, it, I mean, because it was a pretty brand new van.
It was a fighting Texas A&M.
Well, I worked at a law firm. I had a decent job. I got a nice van. It was an 8-passenger Ford, a club wagon. They're not called club wagons anymore. You know, kind of a reddish maroon.
Maroon. Heavier on the maroon.
Yeah. Yeah, but from the Aggies thought it was maroon. So got the van. Man, trusty van.
Oh, yeah.
And
we had one big problem with it ever that I ever – the alternator scene. Yeah, that okay. One deal. The Robert O'Keefe Festival deal. That was the one time it ever –
it had any trouble.
Conked out
yeah,
on
that's
yeah.
right. That's right. It was very, very trustworthy. Never pulled a trailer. I think that's the – some of the
it's the hidden gold.
The hidden gold to how, why it's lasted so long. Yeah. Well, we played the show at Fitzgerald's, Houston, Texas, Rock and Roll Club upstairs. Jack Ingram was there. He came on stage. We had this great night. It still kills me to this day because I remember Ingram was the last guy to play my black Takamine acoustic guitar, which I loved. And Chris Masterson was the last guy to play my little red and white Stratocaster. That I had bought. It kind of had a crooked neck on it, but it was a pretty good guitar. I'd bought it at Austin Vintage Guitars a couple of years before. So when they came on stage, that was kind of some of the backup gear. So Ingram had my black Takamine. Masterson had my red and white Stratocaster plugged into my big silver face super reverb amp.
Oh.
All this gear.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't remember why we had so much. I remember we had a ton of beer in the car. Why was it? Remember we had all that beer between the seats?
Oh, yeah.
We had a deal with our friends at Budweiser in those days.
And Stolle was in the band.
And Jason Stolle was in the band. Yes. I'll have to take that out. But,
we still love you, Stolle.
Nice, Stolle. Well, we did. We played a lot of cards.
Oh, yeah. Poker chips.
Drink some beer.
Beers in there.
Beer was a big part of it.
There's a lot of CDs in there, by the way. And the little portable CD deal that plugs into the tape deck. That guy was in there with a big bend of, like, the Jayhawks and all the good albums.
All our CDs in there.
Everybody sung along to.
Of course, we had the gear. So we pack up at, like, you know, Fitzgerald's. We go to this. And the next show is in Anahuac, which is kind of southeast of town.
Yeah.
So we stay on the east side. Jordan Powell, I believe. Booked the room through Priceline or something. So we roll into the Motel 6 at whatever it was,
three
or four in the morning.
Yeah, you guys closed it out.
Closed it down.
It was
that
an
night.
Ingram.
Well, we hadn't seen Jack and the guys for a while, and Jordan was there with
uh-huh.
Jack, and had a great time. And so we get to the hotel, and we go to sleep. I remember waking up the next morning, and I had to get. My phone was ringing. I said, man, I got to get my phone charger out of the van. So I go running outside. I just come downstairs, and there is just a gigantic empty parking place right at the foot of the stairs where we parked the van.
I was immediately blamed.
So I was like, what is going on? Now, we have had a couple pranks on the road from time to time where guys have taken the keys and moved the van around or borrowed it to go pick somebody up. So it wasn't that weird, but it was early, and I knew that none of these other guys were getting up, and I was out there, my bare feet in a t-shirt and jeans with my phone,
yes,
my keys out, and there's no car there, and it just starts to set in, and I'm like, somebody must have. So we go, I run back upstairs.
I can still hear
a couple hotel
coming
rooms.
Up the stairs,
bang on the door. Where's the van? Where's the van?
It was a rare occasion, though, because in my tenure, there was maybe twice when I was allowed to drive the van. Maybe twice.
Yeah.
And one of those rare occasions was that night, because Ingram and Phil had just closed it down. And
yeah, it was late. It was late.
They
talked let you drive, right.
all night long and closed the bar down. And so I drove back. And so the next morning, it was like, Walker, where's the van? Like, I had lost the van.
Yeah, right. And sure enough, one by one, we all awaken. Well, Shane Hildreth was with us that show.
Yeah, Shane was not staying with us, but he was at his house.
Well, he's from Houston, yep. Shane, so he was not in the hotel with you, me, and was it just you, me, and
it's
Stolle?
It's you, me, and Stolle. You and Stolle were in one room because y'all always got a room, and I was with whoever bass player was with it. It was Ryan
always
or Shane.
Always room to Stolle because he didn't snore. Very good sleeper, very clean guy, very clean, just laid down, went to sleep. So now we're all in full panic mode.
Oh.
We go down. We can't, but we're all just down there staring at this empty place. And, there's not – what struck me was there was not a – shard of glass. No sign of a break-in, of any activity, no clues at the scene, nothing.
It was weird because
clean.
usually when you woke us up, Phil always got up first, and he was very meticulous about coffee in the morning, and up around 8 or 9, and would usually tell us the night before, hey guys, we're getting up at 8, or hey guys, we're getting up at 9, or whatever it was. And this particular morning, I remember we got like an extra hour of sleep. He's like, hey, we're going to get up at 9 or something. And so Shane had of course, gone back to his house, and Phil knocks on my door, and he's in his jeans, white T-shirt, and black socks, and he's just banging on the door. And I get up, and I open the door, and I kind of rub my eyes, and Phil's – it's kind of like that weird feeling when, like – because Phil was like our dad on the road, because he's been – he'd been on the road
come
for
off.
Some time. So I was very –
I was the old guy. I was the older guy.
I was very green. So Phil never, ever gets nervous or panics on the road, because he's seen it all. You know, he just doesn't – to see Phil panic about something, or to kind of break a sweat and kind of look at you like he's looking for me for the answer, which is very, very rare, was
not
very,
a good sign. You knew something was wrong.
It was unsettling for
sure. That was very unsettling.
Banging on the door, just standing there looking at me. And Walker, man, where'd you put the van? And I'm like, oh man, it's right there at the front of the hotel. So the door closes, and I hear him, you know, go down the stairs again. And I try to go back down to sleep, and then I hear boom, boom, boom on the door again. It's Phil, and this time,
it was not good.
Now he's pacing,
not good.
He's pacing back and forth. He's kind of wiping the sweat off his brow. It's hot outside, and he's like, man, it's not there. And so I start to freak out a little bit, because I was the last one to drive it. And I start running through all the scenarios that happened. Like, I know I locked it. I know we did this. And I always give Phil the keys back. And so I start going through all the scenarios. Like, someone could have followed us home from Fitzwillie's or not Fitzwillie's, Fitzgerald's, whatever the case may be. But I do remember at about 3 o'clock when we exited the van, it was me, Stolly, and Phil, and we had not checked in yet. And it was kind of a shady place, because they still had someone at the front desk to give us our key at like 3 a.m.
Yeah, right.
So we walk directly past this dude in a golf cart.
Yeah, and they had that was the whole deal the next morning. They did have a security guy. Had to be an inside job.
I know it is. To this day, it's an inside job. Had to be. And the dude's in the golf cart staring at us, because, of course, it's like the Bob Seger song.
Of course, it's late in the morning. We're kind of loud. We're tumbling out of the
place. Yeah, and they're in
some rock band. You know.
They're just, he's just eyeballing us like we're going to rob the place.
To this day, I think that's probably the appropriate theory. And you called the guy, the security guard, the next morning.
Oh, yeah.
Give me that guy's number.
Yep.
And you kind of grilled him and said, hey, man, you were out in the parking lot last night. What happened? He's like, oh, I don't know. You know.
Yeah, it was total snow job. That guy totally ripped us off. He watched us walk in at about 3 a.m, and we got the key, and he's the last one to see us. I don't think anyone followed us home.
Oh, no doubt.
I think that guy called his buddy who owns a pawn shop or something.
Yeah,
and they
said,
came
hey, guess who just rolled up here?
They jacked the van.
A bunch of suckers. So what had happened? So, boy, we called the cops. We're there in
the lobby, just hot. No coffee yet.
Hot, no coffee. Everyone on edge.
Everyone's
the funniest thing was our bass player, of course, the great Shane Hildreth from Houston. a great player, great guy. Now, Shane, he just kind of come on to fill some gigs when Ryan Lynch, we kind of had Ryan would play sort of the North Texas, West Texas.
Yep.
Shane would play sort of Houston Corpus, because they both had really good jobs.
Yep.
And it was kind of hard for him to get away on Fridays. So Shane, being a man of means, a man well employed at the time.
Well, and plus, I think his dad like owns the Houston Astros.
Yeah, well, he's in marketing, a vice president. Great guy. His parents were great people. Oh, Shane's folks and
came to every show.
Yeah, they bring all their friends. It was great. So Shane, of course, we're all panicked. So we call Shane. So Shane, well, you'll never forget. Guess what happened? He said, "What? And he said, man, the van got stolen, man. Your bass rig, your bass, everything is gone. It's gone. It's gone." And to his credit, he just very calmly says, well, I said, man, get up here now. I mean, we got the cops showing. We got to file a report. I'm just freaking out. Shane just kind of says, well, I'm just getting up. I mean, what do you want me to? I'm like, man, you got to get up here. This is happening. Come on. He just says, all right. Well, let me, I'm going to get up and go work out. I'm going to take a shower. I'm going to get some coffee and something to eat.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we're
and when
blistering
I'm done with that,
heat.
When I'm done with that, I'll be up there.
Yeah.
I love that reaction. I was just like, man, this guy, Shane was, of course, he didn't like hearing his gear was had been ripped off, but was certainly no hurry. He was not going to upset his routine for this.
Not at all.
There's nothing he could do about it now, maybe he figured after all.
As we're so staying in the lobby, just sweating and pissed.
Of course,
pissed
the cops. I mean, how many times does an East Side Houston police officer hear this story? A bunch of sad
once a week.
Sacks, you know, just kind of going, hey, man, someone stole our car. Well, just to carry out the story here, we filed the report and all that, went home. or we went, we played the Anahuac gig with no, had no gear, so I rent a car and
borrowed everything from Honey Brown.
So Honey Brown was playing before us or something, and we talked him in. We played a lot of shows in those days. We shared booking agents. So I went to our good friend Fred Andrews and their guitarist, my old friend Alex Whedon, who's with Miranda Lambert these days with Jordan. Said, man, we need some gear. We got all our stuff. Of course, everybody was very sympathetic. And
except for Corey Morrow. I do remember Corey.
Well, he kind of shrugged.
Strolling backstage and like,
was it? I don't remember it that way.
I was a huge Morrow fan, so yeah, I was kind of.
Well, he was the last guy, right?
In those days, I was always still trying to eyeball, you know, somebody I was a big fan of. And he kind of strolls backstage in his $300 jeans and he's drinking an imported beer and he walks by and we're all just like, you know, everyone's captivated by our story and Phil's telling a great story and everybody's listening. And Corey kind of walks by as he like reaches for a lighter and he's like, ugh. That sucks.
Yeah, that sucks.
Just walks off. I was like, "Hey, nice to meet you, Big Gold." Well, say, "Well, see you later."
Hey, man, he had other. He had a show to play, stuff on his plate that day.
Yeah.
Well, it is true, man. It's a story you hear a lot. Unfortunately, guys, trailers, and I remember after this happened, Robert Kearns, Ingram's bass player at the time, and his bass player once again now, who Robert from I think Seattle started the band, the great band, the Bottle Rockets.
Great movie.
Good friend of ours said that, you know, he's kind of going around, hey, he's kind of his high voice. Phil, we need to do something for those guys, have a benefit or something. And I was like, man, we've got this big benefit, you know, so we can get some gear. And I think that didn't last very long. I mean, it's the thought that counts. And then after that, you know, a day or two later, everybody's got their own problems they're worried about. They don't worry about your van.
Nobody donated anything.
So we filed the report. We somehow pulled the show off in Anahuac on borrowed gear.
The Gator Fest.
Gator Fest, yes.
Depressing Gator
Mark
Fest.
Mark Taylor events. Oh, it was fun. There was a lot of people. And then they had a big dead gator out there hanging over the lake.
Oh, yeah. Remember that? They did it right.
And they had the fried tails and all that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, man, it was a down... Boy, what a downer, man. I mean, everybody, but you know, everybody was insured except me. Stolly, I know, filed and got his kit, new drum kit. Shane had some stuff. Shane did not have his Fender Precision Bass, his pre-CBS, whatever it was, 64 bass, was not in there. It was just kind of a backup.
I think he lost some croakies in the heist or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So he had some stuff was gone. And the funny thing was, Stolly just said, man, my only image is just of some dude busting in that van at 4 in the morning. Mike goes, Stolly's cell phone was in the van, charging. He just goes, he picks up my cell phone, calls his buddies. I'm coming home, baby. He goes, and not only does he have all this gear in the back, all this vintage gear just piled. He said, we had just the 25 cases of beer just piled in between the seats that Budweiser had loaded us down with from a previous engagement. Oh, man. So the van did turn up, though. I got a call like at midnight. I was sound asleep in my house in Fort Worth about a week later, or maybe just a few days later.
It went too
long. I said, sir, we have found your van. And I was like, oh, is it all right? And they said, well, it's, you know, it was just abandoned in the woods somewhere. So we go to a place down there. Did you go to the place to pick it up with
me? We borrowed my brother's car. And
I remember that. We drove
down and did a couple shows, and then we picked up the van and some impound lot right outside of Houston.
Yeah.
And they let us go over, and we're all excited. And we're thinking when the van gets open, there's going to be something cool left, you know. And so, of course, Phil is the glasses half full guy.
Thanks,
so,
'cause everybody thinks I'm a pessimist. Thank you for that.
The door's open, and I'm telling you, man, I've never seen the floor of that van. It has always been so packed with stuff. And so the door opens. There's not a poker chip. There's not a... There's nothing in there.
They vacuumed the carpet, practically. I mean, it was just spotlessly clean.
Phil kind of crawls in there. There's a couple tapes. There's a tape deck and there's a couple tapes, like some Springsteen B-side, some Bob Dylan tape. And then there's like this wadded up black T-shirt, like just sitting shoved under the seat. And Phil kind of pulls it out, and it's like this Steely Dan 1988 tour shirt.
Yeah, Phil, Steely Dan shirt.
And Phil's just like, yes! He's like, they left the Steely Dan shirt, and nothing, there's not even carpet left in the van, and he's got his Steely Dan shirt.
Salvaged from the wreckage. The wreckage.
So excited about the Steely Dan shirt. It was awesome.
Small victory. Small victory that day. Yeah, they fixed I think the windshield was smashed up. Of course, they had the steering column of the... but they, you know, they'd obviously just, you know, had just hotwired it right through the steering column. But lo and behold, the van was back.
Oh,
man, I had had the same gear insurance for years and years and years. They'd always done a great job. And man, lo and behold, I know this because my policy renews every June. This must have been like July. Or August. Had not renewed. I called it in. Nothing.
Beating.
Sorry. Nothing. So, I got wiped out in the gear. So, I was lucky that that the van surfaced again, because I'd have had to buy a new van. And, and it had hundreds of thousands of miles on it. I mean, it wouldn't have been worth a whole lot. So, it was good that the van was recovered. And, man, the van, it's in service today. We still have the van. 356,000 miles on it.
Still rocking and rolling.
Original transmission, original engine. But
there was an alternator changed in that van by these hands.
Oh, several times.
Hands changed an alternator.
It might be a story for next for the next week's podcast. The alternator at the Palestine and Robert O'Keefe show.
Oh, yes.
Where we'd drive for 30 minutes, the battery would die.
Charge it, keep driving.
We put in a new battery, drive it 30 minutes, the battery would die. That lasted, when the battery would die, the van, we would just coast, I mean, all the power would go out. Very dangerous.
Just good times.
And Tyler, where we went over there and, oh boy. Story for another time.
Remember, though, when Shane was getting a pedicure or whatever he was doing when he was waiting to come to come get us, we're sitting there.
Well-employed bass player, Shane Hildreth.
We're sitting there waiting on him, and we kind of walk over to Burger King, which we normally you'd never see. Phil wouldn't eat Burger King. He'd find some place in that town that he always eats at that's like a mom-and-pop shop that he loves.
It's the only place I go.
And so we walk
very
over.
Very particular.
We walk over to Burger King, and we're all sitting there, and it's never been so quiet. I mean, usually me and Phil are talking about like some movie or some music or something stupid, and we're just sitting there eating, and Stolly kind of looks at Phil and he's like, did you have music insurance or whatever? And I was like laughing because I thought it was a joke. I didn't know there was such a thing as music insurance. I thought it was fictitious. And Phil just kind of looks at him while he's chewing and just no. And then the rest of that conversation was silence. We just sat there in Burger King all kind of waiting on Shane, just wondering what we lost.
Oh, it had all been lost, man. So it was a long. That was when I started playing. Jordan Powell gave me some gear. He gave me his.
The great Jordan Powell.
To use, which I still have in my possession all these years later, a small Music Man amp.
We'll never give it back. I'm sorry.
Wow. So that's when I started playing those Music Man amps, a couple of Squire guitars, and it's kind of funny. Over the years, I've kind of grown an affinity for those types of instruments. And also the knowledge that hey, if this stuff gets ripped off, I can go to the Guitar Center and buy another guitar for $200. So it was kind of a lesson, man. There's a lot of guys on the prowl out there, and we started drawing a lot of people to the shows, and we're traveling with a lot of gear and playing a lot of shows. So just man, your odds start to go up if you're out there every Friday and Saturday night, staying in some little motel. With a car full of gear, you better be on your guard at some point. Now, the trailers, the bands we pulled trailers, got ripped off all the time because you can unhitch those things. You can open the side of one of those things with a can opener. You can just kind of go in there and grab whatever. So we were all kind of lucky because our van would sort of blend in. We could back it up somewhere and it wouldn't stand out as a band vehicle. Sad days, but we came through it all right, didn't we, Walker?
We did. I'm just kind of wondering where... There's some guy in Houston that gave Phil Pritchett T-shirts and CDs for Christmas every year for the last 10 years.
If you know who that is, give me a call.
He just walked away with like three huge trundles of merch.
Well, plus, we had called all the Guitar Centers and pawn shops. I mean, those amps were pretty reasonably unique. I mean, they were you got an old Silverface Twin, old Silverface Super. So they all had to show up on the market somewhere. I don't know what happened to him, man.
I don't know where the merch ended up, or the poker chips, or the rest of the CDs.
I bet the beer's not around. It's long gone.
Golly.
The day the van got stolen, I think it was, in the middle of the summer, 2004, we're living right about
it. What a beating.
Thanks for going down memory lane with us there, Blake. Painful though it is, but in hindsight, we can all have a good laugh about it.
Oh, yeah.
That's what keeps us going in this business, a good, healthy laugh. Coming up, we're going to get into the P2 Vault, which we always do in our final segment. Man, we usually, a lot of times we look at a classic album, stuff on Phil's iPod that gets a lot of play. But we're going to look at an actual Pritchett record this time. We're going to go into the story behind the making of the landmark 1997 recording, Phil Comes Alive, Austin, Texas. We're going to get into that in our next segment. Stay tuned.
Well, when I was 2, I moved to Texas. Sad to leave the United States. But now I'm saying let's secede, 'cause I don't wanna wait. So I'm taking my Texas flag down to the South Pole. I'm gonna make myself a capital in an Alamo out of snow.
The P2 Podcast, coming to you weekly from Trinidad World Recording Studios in Fort Worth, Texas. I am Phil Pritchett. For all things about the band, to book us for your next event, to buy our records, to look at the recording studio, go to philpritchett.com. You can also download any one of our records for just $4 at p2tunes.com or get it also at iTunes. We're talking today about, with our friend Blake Walker is
hello,
here.
Hello, hello.
Thanks for being here, Blake.
Absolutely.
Former Phil Pritchett, full band road manager.
Lackey.
Walker, Texas road manager.
Cheerleader.
Merch monkey, other derogatory terms bands call their merch guy.
It sure beats working.
That's right, man. A lot of fun. And look at all the stories you can tell now.
Oh,
You didn't make any money with us, hardly.
Memories. Memories.
$20 a week or so with us.
Yeah. I spent most of it on the road anyway.
But here you are.
So worthless.
Here you are.
Had a blast.
We're gonna venture back into the P2 vault here. We've covered everybody from Elton John to Willis Allen Ramsey to Tom Petty, Robert Earl Keen. Picking out little elements about each recordings we like. We're going to look at Phil Comes Alive. This was the second CD that I ever made. Of course, in 96, I made my first record, Phil World, which we covered on a previous episode. Wrote some songs. I was coming out of college. You know this, Walker. I was kind of into the Robert Earl Keen kind of deal. Like any guy, it was hard to... You couldn't escape that net in those days. You were intrigued with... You did look at Jerry Jeff Walker and Joe Ely. These are stars, guy. You read about them touring with The Clash or something, or partying with Jimmy Buffett, in Walker's case. Very distant, gosh, these guys are from outer space. But, man, Robert Earl Keen was kind of the guy. We talked about him a lot on this show. His name always inevitably comes up. But he did, aside from being a talented, funny guy, he'd gone to school at A&M. He was just kind of a Texas guy. He opened a lot of doors, man. He was just kind of doing his own thing, existing outside the mainstream, and then people really dug it. He was their guy. So we were all kind of on a big Keen kick. I had written those 10 new songs for Phil World. Maria, Luke Skywalker, Indiana Jones, Dishwater Hands among them. But of course, that's only 10 songs. So I had to play all these shows. We were playing a lot of fraternity parties and that kind of stuff in Austin. So we needed a set. Well, in high school I had written a lot of pretty silly songs at times with friends. My old friend Wes Cunningham from high school, my friend Chip Evans, who I went to school with, college and high school. And man, that's where these songs come from. I mean, me and Chip wrote Rollin'.
Down your Coca-Cola, son, and let's go grab a brew. We got miles of Texas highways just waiting to be found.
Drake, when I think, these are like kind of joke songs we wrote, just sitting around in the fraternity house or riding in the back of some truck somewhere. Just kind of these funny songs. And so when I would play a show, I would throw these songs in there just sort of flesh out the night.
All you need is old Milwaukee, the silver bullet, or the feast.
But inevitably, of course, people at these shows we're playing start saying, man, play the drinking one, the rolling one. I was also in an acoustic duo in college called Romantic Embargo.
Ah.
Two-man acoustic. Do you remember that you ever run that across that CD?
There was a time, I think the first CD that could ever be downloaded off P-Tunes, they gave you...
Oh, a couple MP3s.
Some MP3s of Romantic Embargo.
Yeah.
So, and I'd always heard you talk about it, but then we got to kind of, once we downloaded some bootleg stuff off the P2 tunes, then they gave us the Romantic Embargo.
So yeah, we made James DeWitt, a friend of mine from college, funny, kind of crazy guy, real high energy. He'd flop around and dance, and I was kind of the straight guy, if you can imagine that. I was kind of the laid-back guy, and he was the wild guy. Kind of a pre-Tenacious D kind of deal.
Very nice. Very nice.
But he had his own funny songs. And so So me and James did a lot of those kind of drinking songs. So when I kind of had my own thing going here in these years, man, even like Meet Me in Las Vegas and Katarina with stuff Romantic Embargo played quite a bit. Alive on 35 was a Romantic Embargo song, Beyond Core. So these were the... So, you know, I'd written kind of what would become the new Suburban Legends album. But before I put that album out, I really wanted to get a recording of some of these songs everybody knew that, you know, wasn't recorded really anywhere in any current Phil Pritchett form. So that was the impetus behind Phil Comes Alive. Now, we were playing Wednesday nights at a now forever closed place called the Side Street Bar. It was right off 6th Street in Austin, in an upstairs room. God, it was like this old building. It was great. You walked into a small bar downstairs, and then you go up these stairs, and there's just a big room. Maybe, you know, not, we're talking about Fitzgerald's in Houston. Similar, not as big. And we played every Wednesday night there. And we had a big, started to get a good core of, you know, college folks in there. A lot of people from the University of Texas swim team had, we played a lot of their private parties, and they had a lot of wild parties and stuff. We would play, me and Romantic Embargo would play. Crazy swimmers, man. Hey, you know, everybody was surprised by this Michael Phelps deal. Not me. Not me. But yeah. Anyway, we'd go in there every Wednesday. It was just a rowdy deal. So, you know, not having a lot of money or anything, I just said, man, let's just somehow record one of these things, which was a little easier said than done. So we hired this guy, Larry Sire, who was had a studio, but he had the remote recording rig, meaning like some old van with carpet in it and like a board. So he parked next to the building, and he was in the truck, and then we actually ran a cable like a snake up the side of the building, wrapped around the drain pipes, into the window.
FBI phone tap.
Yeah, outside, something like that. Like, guys were shimmying up poles and things to get this done.
That's awesome.
So we're in there, so we run the cables all the way up through the window, out into the street. And, man, that was the first time. Those Wednesdays were always big. We were talking it up, of course, leading up to it. And, man, that was the first time that I ever remember showing up to one of my gigs. And we got close to the bar, man, and there was a lot of cars and a lot of people out front.
It was an occasion.
It was like, whoa, man. There's
you can hear the crowd well.
What's going on here tonight? Who's playing tonight?
And like any good chewing tobacco song, it goes like this. Well, people say I snuff a lot, but I just don't care. I just bought a new can. And there's plenty of snuff to share. But if you ask me for a dip, well, it might turn you green. I'm a snuff machine. Well, now Mama says it's bad for me, and you know she's probably right. But if I didn't have my snuff, you know I sure would be uptight. So I'd rather have a Truly left. Snuff machine. What's that you say? I'm a snuff machine.
So that was a fun night. So we went in there, and everyone was just, of course, really into it. We were just egging them on the whole time. Played all those fun songs, and everyone was really participating and having a good time. What really stands out about that was it was like the second show for Keith Robinson, my drummer. Okay. We had just lost Mark Baker, who played on Phil World, one of my old friends from high school. So Keith was brand new to the songs, and my bass player, Kevin Jecker, the man on the fretless bass, older than me, they were experienced guys, and you know, I just kind of started playing like electric guitar. I'd always been a guitar player, but really some of my first forays into electric guitar. I had an old G&L that I played, and then, of course, my Takamine right over here in the studio. So that was Phil Comes Alive, and man, when it came out, I didn't have a lot of aspirations for it. I thought it'd be kind of a bootleg kind of deal. Where'd you say you heard it from? Arkansas State? Or
some frat guys at Arkansas State had brought it back, passed it around my high school.
So well, yeah. it really, no question, really made the rounds. And you know, I think there's just a lot of appeal for a live record at that time. You know, guys having parties and stuff like that. It was something you could throw in front of people and everybody would... you could kind of envision the crowd and get a real feel for it, you know. There was a great band in Austin, Soul Hat.
Oh, yeah.
It was just huge, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And they did a record called Live at the Black Cat Lounge, one of their Tuesday nights or whenever they played there. Great stuff, man. So I kind of had a, and I remember talking to them a little bit about how they recorded on it, and we got a guy in a truck and all that. So I kind of had a beat on how to do it. But lo and behold, some of those songs are the ones we still play every night. You know, of course, we did another version of Maria. We did You Meet Me in Las Vegas, which is really the only recorded version of that song in my whole catalog. We really never did a studio version of Meet Me in Las Vegas, but it was on there. And anyway, a lot of fun, high energy, fun deal, just recorded in one night. A lot of these guys do these live records. They do they record like 12 shows and take the best cuts and do overdubs. And man, we didn't do any of that. We recorded it all in a row, you know, and then just mixed it, and that was it, you know. But Phil Comes Alive, you can get it at, you know, p2tunes.com. Of course, anybody listening to this podcast probably got Phil Comes Alive, don't you think, Walker?
Yeah.
Probably got a few copies somewhere. Yeah, of course, my complaint, everybody's like, man, I'll sell that copy to some guy at a show, and he'll just kind of shake his head and go, man, I think I've bought like 12 of these over the years. People keep stealing them, or they break, or I lost it, or I just keep buying them, you know. But
it's a great album. I know on your first podcast, I was listening to the great Kurt South was saying, he said it's like when you record, it's a snapshot of just that time and a Polaroid of where you're at, and you know, at that time, and I guess when I got a hold of it in '98, though, that style, that live. Just kind of fun songs, and that album was it was really hot at that time, because I know the Green Hall live album for Pat Green was really popular for him, his live at Green Hall, and it had the same atmosphere, a loud crowd, very good
live
show.
Now Ingram did live at Green Hall, didn't Pat have something else?
Wait, Pat had a live at Green Hall at that time too, and it was really
popular.
Well,
that's right, he'd done it there, and he'd done another night in College Station, right? Uh-huh. That whole live right.
But those were that was passed around all over the place. And so was a bunch of other live. Corey Morrow went on and did his double live acoustic.
Right.
And those were so popular at that time. And that was, everybody was doing that at the time. But it's, in my opinion, still, even after, you know, the October Stages one, the bootleg one, and the Cool and Unusual Punishment, I still love that old school, that early Phil Comes Alive. And
it's just me. Most of the songs, it's funny. They're so simple. It's just a train beat. The drums, the bass, and I'm playing acoustic and singing. It's really just kind of a glorified singer-songwriter show. It's not it's not, you listen to Cool and Unusual Punishment. There's a lot of harmonies. There's a lot of I had the big amps then, and was doing a lot more guitar playing and stuff like that. I'm always struck by how simplistic it is. When it comes on, I'll hear it on the radio or in a club somewhere, and I'm like, God, who is this? You know, it's just an acoustic guitar and kind of a shuffle beat, a little bass, and it's my roommate or something comes banging out. I'm like, yeah, I think that's me. But Phil Comes Alive. Go grab it. You know, if you know somebody who's interested in the band, or, you know, it's always been a really good, people have, you know, usually buy two or three of those at a show, because it's kind of the Phil Pritchett and the full band starter kit, wouldn't you agree? Kind of
absolutely.
Like, man, you get into this first. When you're a little more advanced, you get into maybe some of the other, the Bullfighter, Suburban Legends, or something like that. But, you know, see if you dig kind of what this is about, and
it's the only place you're going to get the encore song, and
yeah, that's right.
And Las Vegas, and those two are great songs.
Well, that was really important to me. I didn't want to put out an album with just the same songs on the last record.
Yeah,
of course, that's what everybody does. They just keep doing more. We did have Maria, that was on there, but other than that, the other ones were not and have been on no other Phil Pritchett albums. I remember I said, man, I want it to be live and raw, but I want new songs, so that people, if you have Phil World, you got 10 songs, and then you have a unique, whatever it was, 12 songs with the live version of Maria. So all songs for the catalog, man,
good times
out there banging around. Well, thanks for being here today, Blake Walker, Texas Road Manager.
You are welcome.
The
anytime.
Great Blake Walker.
Anytime, brother.
Go to philpritchett.com for all your questions regarding the band. You can email me, phil@philpritchett.com, about booking, about coming to the studio to record, anything like that. And, of course, buy the records at p2tunes.com or on iTunes. Subscribe to this podcast. This is where you hear everything from the straight from the horse's mouth here. So we got some more episodes coming up. Thanks for being here again, Blake. We leave you all now. Have a great week. We'll be back next week. At the same time, join us again for the P2 podcast. Take care out there.
My- man. That's all we have, folks. Thanks for coming out tonight. You were great. Thank you. See y'all next Wednesday night.